from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In her new book, Why We Dream, science writer Alice Robb argues that dreams are not silly little stories, the dandruff of the brain. Rather, she says, dreams can help us form memories, manage anxiety, and spark creativity. We'll discuss the latest science behind dreams with Alice Robb and Harvard psychologist and dream researcher Deirdre Barrett. And we'd like to hear from you. Have your dreams helped you solve a problem or help you cope with stress or trauma? It's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Sigmund Freud famously wrote that dreams are never concerned with trivia. His theories about the central role of dreams as pathways to the unconscious eventually fell out of favor, as sleep scientists theorized that dreams are simply the brain's attempt to make sense of the random firings of neurotransmitters. But contemporary research suggests that dreams do, in fact, have deep links to emotion and that they can help us cope with anxiety and trauma, solve problems, and inspire creativity. We're going to talk about what we know about the causes and meaning of dreams in this hour. We're joined in studio by Alice Robb. She's the author of Why We Dream. She was previously a staff writer for The New Republic. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Deirdre Barrett. She's an assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Her books include The Committee of Sleep and Trauma and Dreams and Supernormal Stimuli. Welcome, Deirdre Barrett.
Hi, nice to be here.
Good to have you with us here. And Alice Robb, let me begin with you. I came across a quote by Oscar Wilde, which you're probably familiar with. He said, the most frightening thing is if somebody begins a sentence with, I had an interesting dream last night. A lot of people do think that dreams are just, you know, effluvia or some kind of boring thing that people shouldn't necessarily relate or narrate to us. And yet Freud said they were the royal road to the unconscious. We're moving in a different direction. And you're saying, you're looking at the science of dreams here, the biology of dreams here, but also how important they can be transformatively.
Yes. I mean, I would argue with Oscar Wilde. There is this really common stereotype that dreams are boring, but I think that just comes from the misconception that dreams don't mean anything. And what we've learned over the past, especially over the past few decades, is that dreams really do tap into profound emotional concerns and things that we've neglected during the day, kind of as Freud suggested more than 100 years ago.
But Freud also suggested that they were, as I said, the royal road to the unconscious. And now a lot of that is being looked at more skeptically. Royal road to what? Maybe royal road to helping us understand ourselves better or understand our emotional inner lives better, but at the same time, not necessarily unlocking repressions that we've kept hidden all these years.
Well, one of the main ideas now about why we dream is that dreams are allowing us to rehearse for things that we're stressed about, and they're giving us this opportunity to work through things in this low-stakes environment where we're actually asleep. So that's why we have so many dreams that are very negative and nightmares. I mean, the most common feelings in dreams include fear and anxiety and guilt. And scientists think that there must be a reason why we're having these experiences that are pretty unpleasant.
But Freud also believed they were essentially disguised wishes. Even if you have a nightmare, he was working with Austrian soldiers and they were having nightmares, and he thought it was a repressed wish to get through what the experience in combat or the PTSD, didn't call it that then, created. But you're talking, when you're talking about the science of dreams, you're talking about so much new technology, neuroimaging and understanding lucid dreaming. In fact, at the heart of your book is rapid eye movement and lucid dreaming.
Yeah. Lucid dreaming is when you have a dream where you're aware in the dream that you're asleep. And a lot of people, including myself, have learned to induce them by doing meditation exercises and sort of mindfulness exercises where you ask yourself throughout the day whether you're awake or asleep. And lucid dreaming can give you even more powerful, you can sort of reap the benefits of dreams sort of extra. Like if you are working through something in your regular dreams and then you summon it up in a lucid dream, you can get that sort of extra kick. And there's something different going on in the brain when you're in lucid dreams. Parts of the brain that are usually dormant during regular dreams are more active during lucid dreams.
Let's talk about lucid dreams with you, Deirdre Barrett. It can make a whole difference in many ways. I mean, it's, I guess, now pretty much been proven that it can solve problems, can help with trauma. It can also really help us through all kinds of grieving and things of that nature.
Yes, lucid dreaming is a remarkable state of consciousness because we have some of our waking logical processes present alongside the dream hallucinatory intuitive ones. Although I'm actually very interested also in other sorts of subtler dream control of just incubating dreaming on a particular problem or topic. And the plus to that is it's easier for most people to do than become lucid. Lots of people hear about lucidity and think, oh, well, I could become lucid and then change my nightmare, or I could become lucid and then think of that problem I want to solve. But becoming lucid is an interesting goal in itself, but if you're not already a proficient lucid dreamer, it's much easier to just say, I want to dream about that problem, or the next time I master my nightmare starts, I want to have a mastery dream instead. And in a week of trying that, about half of people can dream on a particular topic, whereas lucidity takes more concentrated hard work.
Yeah, you got to do all kinds of things to make sure you're lucid, right? I mean, all kinds of suggestions in both of your books about, you know, recording and being pre-conscious about the dreaming state and all that sort of thing.
Well, yeah, as Alice mentioned, you need to achieve a slightly different brain state and wake up your temporal frontal lobes a bit to be able to be lucid, whereas just recalling that you want to dream on a particular topic uses some areas that are already active.
But let's talk about people continue to talk and muse about the transformative power of dreams on so many levels, but one that has always sort of interested me is creativity. And, you know, I remember reading that Robert Louis Stevenson had a dream, and out of that dream came Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And there are many examples of that. In science, there's the benzene ring. There's Kubla Khan by Samuel Taylor Coleridge. I mean, dreams can actually lead to the creative process. They did with Beethoven, I believe, didn't they?
Yes, Beethoven dreamed one of his pieces.
So how do dreams help us in terms of creation, artistically or in our lives for that matter?
Well, I think partly we just keep thinking about all of our usual thoughts and concerns. So I think even if that was all there was to it, that we would occasionally solve problems or have a creative idea in a dream. But there seem to be, I've both done just library and interview research on famous people solving big problems, but I've also had college students incubating brain teasers and incubating homework problems and dreaming solutions. And in both cases, I find that there are two categories of problems that dreams are much likelier to solve. And the first of those is anything that benefits from vivid visualization, because we just see things so much more clearly in our dreams than most people can when they're trying to visualize awake. So whether it's dreaming up a new art piece or something like Kekulé trying to visualize what the structure of benzene was, visual spatial problems benefit from dreams especially. And the other category is any time that the person is stuck on the problem because the conventional wisdom is wrong, the way all experts in the field would be approaching this. The benzene molecule is an example of that too, because all known molecules were some sort of straight line with right angle side chains until then. And so the dream wasn't assuming it has to be a straight line with right angles, but in the dream, he watched a snake made of atoms bend around and take its tail in its mouth and realized that it was a benzene ring. So any time that you need to think outside the box, the dream state lets go of our usual conventional wisdom about how to do this more.
I think even a sewing machine was came about as a result of a dream. Isn't that right, Alice Robb?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk more, though, about what dreams can do in terms of mastery with you, Alice. I mean, people study language and then they suddenly find they have even better mastery than they anticipated because dreams help?
Yeah. A lot of people have noticed that when they become fluent in a language, they also start dreaming in it. And there was a study of people who were learning French that found that during this intensive period of study, they actually had a big increase in REM sleep. And REM is when you have most of your dreams. And that the students who were doing the best were having were also having like trickles of dreams in French. And there are other sort of funny studies. There was one of people wearing goggles that they had to wear goggles that made everything appear to be red. And they found that similarly, people who had dreams about, you know, things being red were acclimating better to this strange situation they were in.
And Deirdre Baird, I alluded before to help in grief and trauma. And this is really quite real, especially with vivid dreams. I remember interviewing Joyce Carol Oates as well as Joan Didion, and both of them were widows, and both of them felt a good deal of comfort and wanted, in fact, to go to sleep because in their dreams, their husbands who were deceased appeared again, comforted them.
Yeah, when I've studied bereaved people's dreams, I find that in the first few days, if they dream about the deceased, it's likely to be an upsetting dream, a little bit like post-trauma stuff. They dream the person is dying all over again. But a bit further down the road, they begin to have dreams that involve the deceased coming to tell them goodbye in a beautiful way if they didn't get to say a proper goodbye. And then even longer down the road, appearing in their dreams just to give them advice as the person is kind of moving on to other concerns in life, the deceased person will often show up just as an internalized, wise part of themselves who cares about their ongoing life.
You also mentioned the visual quality of dreams, and that along with the emotional quality of dreams certainly dominate. But the visual sense of the senses we have is most prominent and most preeminent. And I have to ask you about the sixth sense here, because it always comes into any discussion of dreams. The assumption, I mean, it goes way back to ancient times that maybe they have a premonitory effect or that they could be, you know, predictive or kind of woo-woo mystical stuff. But many people believe in that power in many cultures.
I mean, I think it's not that they're exactly predictive, but that we are processing so much in this kind of looser state of consciousness that we might be interpreting patterns and making predictions. And also that we have so many dreams. I mean, we're dreaming every REM cycle, so 4 or 5 times a night, that it's likely that we will notice some resemblance in real life to something that we've experienced in a dream. But there's a really fascinating history of people trying to use dreams to make predictions about the future.
Ancient prophecy was, you know, all about dreaming, augury as well, of course, birds and things like that. But dreaming played a central role. Also, dreams are part of evolutionary psychology. I mean, part of our survival, really, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think of dreams as just thinking in a different biochemical state, that sometimes there are answers to what are dreams for that are like, you already mentioned, Freud's wish fulfillment, and Revenansu says they're threat simulation. But I don't think we'd ever say what is waking thought for and expect just a simple phrase to be the answer. I think they're just for everything, that we are fulfilling wishes and threat simulating, and I'm not sure Freud was right that they're never trivial. I think a fair bit of dream content does look like it's about fairly trivial concerns, just like with our waking thoughts. So I think we're just continuing to think in this much more visual, much more intuitive, less verbal mode while we dream.
I was always struck by, as a boy, I was a great admirer of Bertrand Russell's, and he said, how do we know that dreaming isn't actually our real life and this life that we're in now that we call consciousness? Not dreaming is a dream life. You know, it's the old idea, what is life built on but dreams, Hamlet and my mother used to say in Yiddish, ganze Leben ist ein Chalom, all of life is a dream. It feels that way and feels that way often. And Alice Robb, let me go back to you just to talk with you a bit about the sense that people can indeed prepare themselves through their dreams. They can also really not only overcome grief and bereavement often. I was curious what Deirdre Barrett said about early instances of almost trauma with death in early dreams, but people can get a lot out of their dreams. I mean, that's at the heart of your book, and they can get a lot out of their dreams in terms of pain, trauma, suffering.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking before about how grieving people have very profound dreams about the person they've lost, but also people who are very sick themselves often have dreams about dying in the run up to dying, about going on a journey or reuniting with people who have already died that they find very comforting. And they're in more sort of everyday situations. There are also, I mean, one of Freud's ideas that I really like was that he talked about a lot of us have had an exam dream, like a nightmare where you turn up to an exam and you realize you forgot to take the class or you forgot to get
dressed. Not dressed in many instances, yeah.
And he said that we have these crazy, you know, these crazy dreams, and then we wake up and we realize that, okay, maybe we have to do something, but at least we don't have to go to a test naked. And that he, in times of stress, would have dreams about this exam that he had been worried about but had ultimately passed, and that this was kind of boosting his confidence rather than dreaming about the exam that he had actually failed.
Isn't there research that shows that students who have anxiety dreams about their tests actually do better in tests?
Yeah. There was a study a few years ago of French medical students that found that the majority of them, three quarters of them, had nightmares about their big exam over the course of the semester, and the ones who had more dreams did actually tend to do better in real life.
Let me go back to you, Deirdre Barrett. How important are dreams, as you see it, to our emotional health generally? I mean, we have to dream. We know that it's absolutely obligatory. Some people claim they never dream, but one has to stretch one's imagination to get around that idea, because almost all of us dream and we're asleep about a quarter of our lives. So is it necessary for emotional health?
Well, certainly we enter REM sleep every 90 minutes. If you wake people up in a sleep lab, they're having dreams. So that state of consciousness, it seems to be consolidating memories. It seems to be doing all sorts of things. But just by us having the experience of it, and there's a big range of difference in dream recall. Some people naturally recall multiple dreams a night, and other people will tell you they haven't recalled a dream since childhood. And that all seems normal range. And although I think that for people who can learn to recall their dreams and think about what they mean, that you get a lot of extra help from that. But on the other hand, I think that there are just so many paths toward knowledge and wisdom and self-growth in this world that if somebody is a very low dream recaller who's using some of those other paths, I wouldn't say that's some sort of deficit. But if you can, they're a wonderful resource.
We have to disentangle, though, and I think you get into this in your book, Alice Robb, about a conference you went to in the Netherlands. Where is the mystical and where is the actual biological or scientific in all this? I remember just a couple of things will be useful here. I remember interviewing an Australian author who had all kinds of interpretations of dreams and different symbolism in dreams and how they were premonitory and how they told us about life in ways that we couldn't divine otherwise. And then I remember interviewing Alan Hobson of Harvard, who's probably well retired and gone by now, Deirdre Barrett, but where you are. But, you know, you're saying it's just flushing out the system. It's just effluvia, flotsam, jetsam. You know, you get rid of stuff that's your neurotransmitters and everything. Mm-hmm. We've got to get somewhere in between those two, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the things that drew me to the topic of dreams in the first place, that it's an area where there aren't really clear-cut divisions. And if you think of something like lucid dreaming, which until the 80s, most scientists believed wasn't a real phenomenon. And it's now been, you know, people thought that maybe people who said they were lucid dreaming were really just waking up, or maybe they were lying or confused. And now we know that that's a real phenomenon that's actually pretty common. And I think it's just an area where we're still learning so much. That conference that I went to in the Netherlands, where I met Deirdre, actually, I think it was a great example of a place where there are people who are, you know, more interested in the sort of spiritual potential of dreams, and people who are coming at it from a more biological perspective, having a real symbiotic relationship.
You mentioned that journey dream. I mean, a lot of people with spiritual ideas would put a lot of, I mean, before they die and that sort of thing, it's like the tunnel and all those sorts of things that come into people's minds when they're approaching death. Deirdre Barrett, dogs and cats dream?
Well, we can't interview them about their dreams. They cycle through REM sleep. They do some woofing and moving in ways that look like they're dreaming. In fact, if they lose their paralysis, there's some experiments that were done in cats back in the 1980s where they would lesion the area that paralyzes you during REM sleep, and the cat would be sleeping peacefully through the rest of sleep, and every dream period it would hop up and stalk around and pounce. So I certainly think that cats are probably dreaming about mice and birds, and dogs are chasing balls and their owners. But that's just from what we know about the physiology of what their brain is doing.
Well, we're having a fascinating discussion about dreams, and we could certainly just even explore what dreams mean in different cultures, because there are vast differences. And what are dreams? I mean, are they prophetic? Are they just flushing out your system? Are they poetic artifacts, as someone once put it? And what do your dreams mean to you? We don't necessarily invite you to tell us about your dreams here, because they can be dull. But we do want to hear your thoughts about what dreams are and what they portend or what they mean to you, and any questions you might have, particularly about lucid dreaming, because that has become in the forefront of dream research. We invite you to join us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Welcome your calls. Again, you can join us toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also become part of the program by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We're talking with Alice Robb, who's here with us in studio, author of Why We Dream, and she was previously on the staff of the New Republic, and she'll be at Books, Inc. in Berkeley tonight at 7. We also have Deirdre Barrett with us on the phone, assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, author of a number of books, including The Committee of Sleep, Trauma and Dreams, and Supernormal Stimuli. And here's Donna, who writes, "I feel I helped save my dad's life when I dreamt he was having a heart attack. I woke up immediately, called my dad, who sounded terrible. I told him to call 911. That night he was in the hospital having heart surgery. That was over 10 years ago. He's alive and doing well." Do hear a lot of those kinds of stories, so you may have some to tell as well. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are mining the mystery of why we dream in this hour and talking about dreams in general with science journalist Alice Robb, who's the author of Why We Dream, and Deirdre Barrett, who's assistant professor of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and author of a number of books, including The Committee of Sleep, Trauma and Dreams, and The Supernormal Stimuli. And we invite your involvement in the program. Here is Kathy in Walnut Creek, who asked, and I'm going to go to you on this, Alice Robb, are there universal themes in dreams, and do they occur across cultures?
There are certain dreams that seem to show up all over the place. One is the exam dream, which I talked a little bit about before. Another is flying dreams, which Freud said were about memories of being rocked as a child. Other people have connected them with
sexual transgression, I remember reading. Yeah.
Another interesting one is teeth falling out, or just sort of problems with your teeth, which there's some, I mean, Freud thought it was about castration. But it may be about, you know, grinding your teeth at night, or there's one idea that it's about, it goes back to an ancestral time when teeth were more important for our survival.
The universal themes in dreams, all one has to do is open Carl Gustav Jung, and you realize that that's his whole psychology in many ways based on, isn't it, Deirdre Barrett?
Well, both Jung and Freud were more nuanced. They did at times say things like, this might represent castration, but they also emphasized that you should ask the dreamer their associations to a symbol. So the idea that of dream dictionaries, they were not into that one symbol always equals the same interpretation for each person. So modern dream therapists do this even more clearly than Freud and Jung by, you know, if you dream of a dog, you don't say, oh, well, a dog is a symbol for X. I know that because I'm an expert. You say, tell me about dogs. What do dogs mean to you? And one person says, they're these cute, fluffy little things that we take care of. And another says, they're big and they have big teeth and they can hurt you. And the next one says, they're man's best friend. They're loyal. So those three dreamers have very different interpretations of what a dog means in their dream. And Freud and Jung both articulated that you should get the dreamer's association, but they're more remembered for at other times, just in Jung's case, saying, this represents the anima archetype, it's the male side of you, without asking, or Freud, some of the, this is castration, this is Oedipal desires. But they did actually get their patients' associations a lot of the time.
Yeah, you've just given us a good primer on the difference between Freud and Jung. I mean, Freud, psychopathology of everyday life, every association is important, and Jung, it was much more mythic, but both also through associations. I'm going to bring our callers aboard here, and let's begin with Rob, who joins us. Good morning, Rob.
Thank you. Have you guys ever heard of substitution of familiar things with things that you've never seen or heard of? I sometimes have dreams that are really vivid, and I wake up, and in the dream, I may be at home, I may be...
I think we lost Rob there. The essence of it, though, Ellis Rob, go ahead. Or Deirdre Barrett, did you want to weigh in here?
Well, yeah, I think that things can easily substitute for each other, that if your dream is basically about the concept of home, that it can actually go either way, that the stimuli today has been your real house, but you see some kind of archetypal, you know, awesome, you know, perfect family home, or you've been watching some sci-fi movie that has home as this other kind of space, but your unconscious gets caught up in issues about homes and represents it as your own. I mean, I think it can go from the general to the specific either direction.
Let me go on to Kathy, who joins us next. Kathy, you're welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Happy Thursday. I'm calling because about 25 years ago, I started having these very terrifying dreams where I would start by being like a buzzing, being sucked down, and then somebody trying to open my mouth and get inside of me, and then I also would be like levitated by them and carried off, and it seemed to only happen when I would be in old homes. And the first place it happened, I was in a home in Park City, Utah, that was built over a cemetery. And so then, of course, I thought it was about spirits, and that spirits would come to me and terrorize me. And so it comes and goes. And right now I live in an old house that it's been happening to me again. And then my nephew is back at West Point, and he just started talking to me about the same type of dreams, and he swears it's the spirits that are in some of the old rooms that he occupies.
Well, you may be in haunted homes, but let's kind of cut to the chase here. I mean, what do we do with those kind of dreams that are so frightening and that seem maybe even particularly linked to something of the occult or the gothic or who knows what? Alice, Rob, you did some exploration of this.
I think dreams are really they really reflect whatever our symbolic repertoire is, whatever our beliefs are. And I think that, I mean, you know, people might be more likely to dream of, you know, dream about going to heaven when they're sick if they believe in heaven. I don't think that has to, you know, lessen the sort of emotional power of dreams like that. But I do think they're pretty susceptible to what we believe.
Well, I'm getting a lot of questions about recurrent dreams. And Deirdre Barrett, let me go to you on that. Jane says, for example, do you have any experience with having dreams with elements of previous dreams? And can you, as another listener, Tosif says, can you explain the phenomenon of recurring dreams?
Well, one thing a lot of different psychologists have said similar things about is the idea that a dream that you just have once is likelier to have been triggered by something that happened that day or at least that week, and is could just be about a simple immediate concern. But one that you have repeatedly across your life is probably about a very core character logic issue for you that keeps getting stirred up by different events at different points in your life. And so I think the first step is just what you do with any dream, to think about the key elements and kind of, you know, what in waking life gives me the same feeling I have in the pit of my stomach when the witch is chasing me down the hall and in that recurring dream, kind of trying to get in touch with what those feelings mean, what they remind you of ongoing issues. But then the second step for the recurring dream is once you figure out what it means, it's really interesting to notice when you have it, because sometimes people are not aware that something that day has triggered a childhood mindset that's only coming out in the dream. So for the recurring dreams, the why now piece is especially interesting, even once you realize what it's basically about.
I'm going to read a tweet from a listener named Vlad, who writes, I had trouble learning how to drive a manual car, but then I had a dream where I was able to do it, visualizing the catch point of the clutch. Sure enough, woke up and drove just fine. Let me go to
Oliver Sacks tells a story about learning to walk with crutches when he'd broken his leg. That's exactly like that. He wasn't handling them properly. He had a dream where he was doing it just right, woke up, walked on the crutches. Dreams solve visual spatial problems. That's a kind of spatial body one very well sometimes.
And Alice, you have a response maybe to a listener named Maria who says, I often have intense frenetic dreams from which I wake up exhausted. Is there such a thing as experience too much REM sleep?
I mean, I have heard of people getting exhausted by their dreams. They might try doing like the opposite of the exercises that people do to try to remember their dreams. I mean, people tend to remember their dreams more if they think about dreams, you know, keep a dream journal, talk about dreams. I guess if you could try not to do those things, you might have a reduction in dreaming.
Let's bring on more callers.
I would also suggest that you try to have soothing dreams. It doesn't have to be not dream, but fall asleep thinking, I want to have one of those beautiful, peaceful dreams of being at the beach.
Does that work?
If you're having disturbing. Yes.
Because I've tried that and I've had nightmares.
About
sometimes.
50% of the time.
Really?
In my studies, if you try to dream a particular topic and you incubate that every night over the course of 1 week, about 50% of people can do it. So that's not a perfect hit rate, but it's also much better than chance.
I'm going to go to more callers, but let me first read a comment from Aaron, who writes, I have very vivid dreams to the extent that I can recall the pattern of a rug on the floor or the cut of someone's suit. My husband, conversely, only dreams in impressions. Can you speak to the different types of dreams in terms of how detailed they are or are not?
I mean, it may be more about the quality of the dream recall than the dream itself. And there are so many things that affect that, like what point in the sleep cycle you wake up. If you wake up directly from a REM period and maybe you wake up naturally without an alarm, you're more likely to have a really vivid grasp of all the details in your dream. But people also do dream differently. It may just reflect a difference in their, you know, dream
and remember
languages.
Differently. I mean, memories work different too, whether you're dreaming or not. Here's Judy. Joins us from San Jose. Judy, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you, and for taking my call, and good morning to you, too. First of all, I had a spontaneous lucid dreaming, and I don't remember my dreams very often. It was awesome. The second thing I wanted to comment was ask about Australian Aborigine dream time, and then just one comment, which is that I am a copywriter, and most of the copywriters I've ever talked to about it, you know, they will always want to sleep on a project, which I assume is engaging sleep in some way or dreaming in some way. Thank you.
Okay. I think the question is maybe about copywriting, but what about the old idea? Let me give you the Sergio Barrett, you know, sleep on it, and maybe you'll come up with a solution or maybe you'll get an answer that you're looking for.
Yes, I certainly think at least part of that phrase has to do with dreams and creative problem solving. And certainly, though, when I was writing the Committee of Sleep and interviewing people about whether they'd ever had a problem solving dream, which lots of them said yes to, a certain subset would say, well, not exactly, but sometimes I fall asleep thinking about a problem and in the morning the answer is just there. And I did find a few examples of people where the answer was just there, and then as they started writing it down and working it out, a dream came back. Oh, I know the answer because of this dream that they didn't recall right at first. But there's also research that suggests that other stages of sleep are having some beneficial restorative, you know, processes for us. So I think other stages of sleep may contribute sometimes to that, but that forgotten dreams account for some of the ones where we're not aware that we wake up having dreamed the solution.
I don't remember whether it was you, Deirdre, or you, Alice, Rob, who said that we know that lucid dreaming is real, but I have a listener who wants to know, please explain how we know that lucid dreaming is real.
Well, the first studies that proved this were done by... There were two researchers in the 70s and 80s, Stephen LaBerge and Keith Hearn, who both devised these experiments where a lucid dreamer would go to sleep in the sleep lab, go into a lucid dream with other people observing, and send signals. So when you're in REM sleep, most of your muscles are paralyzed, but not your eyeballs. So they did these studies where they would move their eyeballs in a pattern that they had agreed on in advance. So with other people verifying, they were communicating from within the dream that they had entered a lucid dream.
Wasn't there a study where, I think it was in Japan, where they actually were able to draw somehow what was being dreamed?
Maybe this isn't it. There's one in Japan where they show people all these visual images and see what their brain patterns look like while they're looking at these images. And then once they're in a dream, they're not drawing with their hands, but the experimenters are taking the EEG output and creating on the screen. They're just like, if it looks 80% like the elephant picture did and 20% like the horse, they just superimpose and you get this four-legged animal that's kind of more elephant but a little bit horsey, and then they wake the people up and ask them what they were dreaming about, and the images correspond. So the brain waves are drawing. But Alice has been interviewing lots of researchers. She may know about some other studies related to your question.
That was the same one I was thinking of.
Oh, you were thinking the same one. All right. Let me get another caller aboard here. Moses, join us. You're on the air on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for a great show. So I'm just wondering, and maybe anecdotal, but there are a lot of stories about dreams that have prophetic dimensions or elements, and that may be more common with non-Western culture. And I was just wondering if psychology can, you know, dare to go and actually look into that. I know it's, you know, academically maybe a taboo, but just wondering if there have been any attempts to look into that.
Good question, Moses. Let me go to you, Professor Barrett.
Yes, actually, the journal I edit, Dreaming, has published one of the attempts to pin down that sort of both precognitive dreams sometimes and telepathic dreams. And I have to say that occasionally studies, including the one in our journal, get a statistical significance at a 1 in 20 chance. But the effects, most of them don't, actually. And the effects are pretty weak compared to, I certainly, in studying dreams, I hear so many dramatic examples like the woman that emailed the show earlier about having a dream that a relative was having a heart attack and calling him and finding him in the middle of a heart attack. Certainly there are dramatic examples of that. I tend to take the same stance that Alice was expressing earlier, that it's probably because we're so intuitive and all of our intuitive processes do not get into our conscious mind by day. And so our dreams process off some signals. Someone may have been looking ill in some way that would suggest cardiac things and we didn't consciously register. But I think you've got two people who take the kind of Western scientific point of view on this. And certainly if you went to that meeting she was mentioning of the International Association for the Study of Dreams, you would find some parapsychologists who definitely believe that dreams are tapping into some paranormal other realm.
Now, there are also, you know, random and serendipity kind of type of things that make people, some people interpret that dimension or realm that you spoke of. Maybe you can give some help to a listener of ours, Deirdre Barrett, named Charlene, apropos what we're talking about here. She writes, "My daughter is studying abroad in France. Early yesterday morning, she called us crying about a dream that ended with one member of our family being killed. Any insight on this would be helpful since she's so far from home and very disturbed by this dream." One of the things I suppose is useful is what you just said, Professor Barrett. Most of these dreams don't necessarily materialize.
Right. I mean, I really would reassure her that even though there are these dramatic stories where you dream it and it really happens, obviously those are the ones that everybody repeats for the rest of their life to everyone they know. And any dream where you dream that your uncle is having a heart attack and you call him and he's just fine and, you know, he dies 45 years later of cancer, you don't repeat the heart attack dream over and over. So I would reassure her that the will control stuff does not look like if you dream a disaster, it's going to come true. I think even when it comes true because you're detecting something by intuition or subtle signals, that basically it means you're worrying about the health of that person or sometimes even just of something that person symbolizes for you, whether she's worried about the health of that family member or worried about some, you know, feeling traumatically separated from her family by being that far away. So I would just work on interpreting kind of what in waking life feels a little bit like what's getting exaggerated.
Well, waking life is full of anxieties of all kinds that we're talking about here, and they do invade sleeping life as well. Here's a caller from Sonoma, Richard, who wants to talk about how he works with his dreams. Richard, go ahead. You're on the air.
Psychiatrist, I learned gestalt approaches to get the metaphorical messages by telling the dream either to myself or my therapist or my wife, first person present tense, I'm swimming in this huge sea of molasses, and then I focus on what am I curious about in this dream? Oh, I'm tired. Oh, I'm swimming so hard. Oh, yeah, I'm a workaholic. Here's the message. And then a later exploration of the same dream. Here I am in the sea of molasses. What is my curiosity? Oh, I don't feel alone and scared. Why is that? I'm swimming in a sea of people every day.
Yeah, molasses is sweet, though. Keep that in mind when you think about how you need to maybe get away from drowning in your work life. Thank you for that. Here's Ben who says, can your guests talk about how we experience time in dreams and how that might inform us about our waking experience of time? Alice Robb.
Yeah. I know of a little bit of research on the passage of time in dreams. I think it's been studied with lucid dreams specifically because it is hard to study our subjective experience in dreams. And some people have wondered whether, you know, dreams are actually just generated on the moment that we wake up. But it seems like we are actually, you know, experiencing them throughout our REM phases, which can stretch up to an hour later in the night. But Stephen LaBerge did some studies of the passage of time in lucid dreams where he would have people send an eye signal when they started doing a task and then like counting to 10 and then send another eye signal when they've completed the task. And found that there was, I think the task took a little bit longer in the lucid dream than it did in real life, but that they were pretty similar.
Well, let me remind you that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. We're talking with Alice Robb, author of Why We Dream, and Deirdre Barrett, who's the author of a number of books, including The Committee of Sleep and Trauma and Dreams. And you can indeed, and we invite you to support this radio station, which is always trying to bring you good programs like this. You can simply do it by going to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let's go to Jesse next. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hi. When I was in my early 20s, I was head over heels in love with a girl. And I had a religious upbringing. And I had a dream that she came to me and said, meet me at Hebrews 13th and 4th, and, like it was an address. And I woke up and thought, there's not even a chapter 13 in Hebrews. But sure enough, it was. And it was, the verse was, marriage is honorable in all. And said a couple more things. But I thought that was really interesting because in my subconscious, I didn't even think there was a chapter 13. But it was... So it really seemed like an outside dream, like something came from the outside to talk to me.
By the outside, you mean maybe a celestial force or something like that?
Yeah.
Well, actually, you're getting into the whole question about how the subconscious plays into our dreams. Let me go to you on that, if I may, Deirdre Barrett.
Well, I, again, as I pointed out, you've got to not particularly believing in the paranormal people on talking about this. So there would be other points of view. But I can think of a lot of examples of kind of less emotionally laden material, but where the person had certainly been exposed to the fact, you know, that it was a name that they weren't able to remember when they were awake, or an address of a childhood home that they didn't remember awake, but that would occur in a dream, and when they'd look it up, it was accurate. And I simply think that's a matter of, even though on average our dreaming memories are a little weaker and fuzzier for a lot of things, they do sometimes seem to pick out things that we knew at one point in time and can't easily recall. And I think it may be partially because they're triggers for memory, like emotions and feelings and visual imagery that become more vivid in dreams. So dreams definitely do sometimes recall things accurately that we can't awake.
When we read about dreams, often we're reading about delirium tremens. Why is that, Alice Robb? The DTs that people get when they're under an alcoholic stupor, it's almost as if they're dreaming, I guess, or they're in another altered state of consciousness.
Well, when people are very deprived of REM, which can happen if you're alcoholic, you can sometimes have a sort of like overflow of REM into daytime consciousness. So you might actually be experiencing these little sort of dreamlike hallucinations during the day.
Well, you certainly are, and when you have the DTs, that's indeed what it is hallucinatory. Let me bring another caller aboard here, and this is a caller in San Diego. Patrick, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, thank you so much. I wanted to go back to Carl Jung. He seemed to be the father of dream interpretation, and he believed that all of the dreams basically generated from the unconscious and were basically indecipherable and had some sort of message to the individual. And to throw something else out, the departure from him and Freud was that Freud said, if you dreamt of this, it meant that, period. Jung said, if you dreamt of that, it meant whatever it was to you. So dreams are very, very individual. And he did not have the access to our modern approach to dream interpretation through drugs, chemicals, whatever, and some of the things your guests are talking about.
I would have to kind of codify that a bit, Patrick. Appreciate your call very much, but I think it's safer to say, Deirdre Barrett, that Freud was more in many ways rooted in the individual's unconscious, whereas Jung, as I said, believed in a collective unconscious and a mythic archetypal unconscious.
I would say, having read pretty much what everything each of them wrote about dreams, that they both at various points articulated that dream symbolism is extremely individual and that you can get at it only by questioning the dreamer. And they have some really beautiful examples of getting at some very individual symbolism. But that also both of them at other times did just say they would quote a dream from some person they hadn't even met and say, obviously, this is a symbol of, and in Freud's case, it would usually be something sexual or aggressive, and in Jung's, of something very kind of mythic and archetypal. But they both articulated in principle what most modern dream workers do of getting the individual associations. But you can also find points in either of their writings where they do the opposite. They just say, I know this symbol means this. So it's inconsistencies in the writing that lead to people characterizing one as this way and the other as the other way.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there because we're flat out of time here. But I want to thank you, Deirdre Barrett, and thank Ellis Robb. Thank you both for a rich discussion, and remind listeners that KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein Markham. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.